In the logbooks, Connecticut's Slave Ships and Human Memory, journalist Anne Farrow explores a part of U.S. history that she says we as a nation have collectively forgotten. Farrow writes, it's the history of a labor system that held millions in bondage. At the same time, slavery was an economic machine that generated great wealth for some families and made Connecticut prosperous. The 18th-century logbooks that Farrow used document the travels of three Connecticut slave ships. Its pages illustrate a part of history we seem to have lost. Farrow explores not only that history, but also why and how it was lost. And she includes a personal story about her mother. Anne Farrow joins us from Hartford. Ms. Farrow, thanks for spending some time with us today.
Good morning, Tom.
Now, you've created a very detailed story of the ship's voyages from Connecticut to West Africa, to the Caribbean and back, all from these logbooks.
Yes.
You took this very, very factual list of information, names and quantities and dates, and combined it with the greater history that we do know when it comes to enslavement in the U.S. Was it difficult to bring those two together to tell a human story?
I think it wasn't, Tom, only because when I looked at these logbooks first, I knew I had everything to learn. I needed to understand the mechanisms of ships going from New England to the west of Africa and what kinds of things that they encountered. I needed to explore the slave trade in the part of Upper West Africa where my mariners had gone. I needed to understand the function of how a logbook worked. I needed to understand about their lives. As I began to connect the names in the logbooks to real men in local history, I began to study about them. So I thought I need to build an understory for the logbooks that will explain to the reader why they matter. This is part of the rise of capitalism, and it is entirely based on human suffering. And I thought I need to make the trade itself and its players and its history crystal clear.
Mm. Now, this is history, the extensive Northeastern role in slavery that we don't often, if ever, hear about, even in the 21st century. Has it been altered either inadvertently or purposely or hidden or forgotten? Why is it that it doesn't rise to the surface?
That's the great question, and the question that I will spend the rest of my writing life pursuing. I believe that the story of enslavement is a story that fairly early on was recognized as painful. It didn't dovetail with the way that we wanted to think of ourselves. The great scholar David Blight at Yale says this is the piece of the American narrative that doesn't fit. My feeling after 13 years of studying this material is that the American narrative really doesn't give human enslavement the place that it actually held. We have not taken into our narrative and our histories the immensity, the huge proportional importance of human bondage and its damage. And New England has its own very particular part of this story. Connecticut, in particular, was a major provisioner of the English Caribbean islands where enslaved people from Africa and their descendants were growing sugar for the Western Hemisphere in an agricultural system that shortened their lives, was every kind of misery. I knew about that when I first saw the logbooks, but what I had not understood is that Connecticut men also were in Africa, trading directly for human beings whom they then transported to the Caribbean and some of whom they brought back to New England. So I began looking and finding that even though Connecticut did not have as great a role as Rhode Island in America's slave trade, still we played our part.
You were asked at one point, and you mentioned this in the book, you were asked, what gives you the right to walk into our history? And I believe it was an editor also who challenged you to explain why you were doing this work. Were those questions hard to answer?
Yes, they were. And yet, From the first moment that I saw these logbooks in May of 2004, I felt an imperative to study them and to bring their story forward. Of the people who were transported upon these ships, I felt so deeply that their lives were taken from them to profit us in New England. And yet their names, I don't know where they would exist, if at all. And I felt called to bring their story forward and to try to explore it as much and as deeply as I could. You know, there is so much human reluctance around a story of pain like this. You know, I began to study memory formation so that I could understand the history of New England better. And what I saw modern scientists saying over and over is that when we study history, we look for stories that console us, that conform to what we already know, that reinforce things we believe. And the story of our relationship with enslavement does none of those things.
You quote Henry Louis Gates, Jr. in the preface to the book. He said in part, "We've forgotten our history, then forgotten what we forgot. Slavery is not the book that we know we own but can't find. We don't even know it's on our shelves. It's a book tucked behind other books, and we can't see it." Is that, in a nutshell, what you found?
I think so. When I first saw these logbooks, which are not signed, it's three different voyages aboard three different ships, all in the same handwriting, but it's not a signed document. And I really had no idea who had written it or who might have kept these records, and I had everything to learn. There are references to trading at a place called Bent's Island. I had no idea where Bent's Island was. I didn't know that it's this tiny island, now abandoned, in the Sierra Leone River, in Sierra Leone, West Africa. And yet, when I followed the advice of my mentor, Robert Forbes at Yale, he said, "You need to nail this down. You need to be sure that this document is accurate. You need to find the men. You need to find the places. You need to find the ships, if you can." I found that almost all of that information was not easily gotten at, but it was available. It was, you know, it was in records and in archives and in museums. And I was able to nail down the story that this logbook holds. And I thought, if I can find this information, and I am by no means a trained historian, that means it was available. That documentation is perfectly available. But human reluctance has held us back from it.
You mentioned needing the experience of the physical location of Bent's Island in this case to really complete your understanding of what this was about.
Yes.
What did you mean by that?
Well, when I first began to study these logbooks, I met a man named Joseph Opala, who is a scholar from Virginia. He was at that time at Yale University working on a special project looking for ways to stabilize Bent's Island, which is very fragile ecologically and in other ways. And he fully assisted me in this project and ended up going to Africa with us as our translator and guide. And because he had spent 30 years studying Bent's Island and had never seen these logbooks, he said, "This is the insect in the amber. This is the moment of this history captured as it was being lived. You need to explore it. You need to be in that place."
I'm wondering, did you feel at all, especially on Bent's Island, did you feel at all like an intruder?
Oh, yes.
Walking on those grounds?
I did. I felt as eager as I had been to go to Africa, and as eager as I had been and persistent as I had been in persuading my newspaper to send me there, once I was there, and when I stepped in this abandoned place where you still see the ruins of the slaving castle and where people were sold and bargained for and held in basically a prison, I thought, this is the piece of the risk of this story that I had not seen and that I had not anticipated. And I felt shame. And I thought, what gives me the right to be here with my notebooks and my pens, thinking that I can capture this? And I felt, and continued to feel, throughout my weeks there, a sense of inadequacy to the task.
You tell another story in this book about your mother's struggle with dementia. Why did you include that? How does it connect to the story that the logbooks tell about Connecticut's role in American slavery?
My mother, who was diagnosed with dementia just a little bit before I began this work, she really was my guide in writing the book. And in helping care for her and in visiting her, I began to see that mother's dementia and her diminishment, the things that were happening to her, echoed the same questions that I was asking of New England history. You know, I expected my mother to forget who I was, and she did fairly quickly on. What I had not anticipated is that she also forgot who she was. And she had to begin her life over every day, looking for a coherent explanation of who she might be and what she was for. And her deterioration and suffering showed me the great dependence that we place on memory in our human lives. We look to our past and to what we did last week and a year ago and years ago. That's what anchors us in the present. And I began to see if Connecticut does not recognize in a whole-souled way its own reliance on this enslaved labor and what we did to bring those people here and what we did to keep them enslaved in the Caribbean, if we don't recognize that in a wide and whole way in the Connecticut histories that we tell, how well do we know ourselves? How successfully can we function in the present? So it began to seem to me that the terrible questions of my mother's life were also the questions I was bringing to history.
You mentioned in the book two particular people that were in the logbooks, I believe by name. One was a young girl and one was a woman who could not stop crying. You felt an attachment to them and a need to do something for them?
I did. I felt for them and particularly for the children who begin to die of amoebic dysentery in the middle voyage, going from Sierra Leone to St. Kitts Island. They begin to die of an outbreak of amoebic dysentery, which is at that time called the Bloody Flux. And the log keeper, who was, I believe, very strongly to have been a man named Dudley Saltonstall, a descendant of aristocrats in Massachusetts and Connecticut, he enumerates each day as the children die. And between the people who I mention in my preface, a black man who ran away with his violin, and another woman who was held in Connecticut slavery and who appears in court records and who could not stop crying, I felt a responsibility. I just want the story to be whole. And if you look at the story of early New England, what you see wound through it over and over and over is the necessity, well, what was understood to be the necessity for captive labor. And in all the great early families, you find either, you know, there is a proximity to these captive people. And because their lives have been held so often and for so long in the shadows, I feel it is part of my mission in life to help bring that forward so that they will be understood as central to the story of our making.
Thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.